Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Holgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Coming up on the show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by John Chin, and three reviews for the price of one. Sam, we're going to do things a little bit different here.
Yeah, we've
on
been
this
busy.
Edition of Film Spotting. We have been busy taking our listeners' suggestions.
Right.
We were going to do an art house roundup, reviewing the movies The Proposition and Down in the Valley, the new Western with Ed Norton, the new take on the Western. And Roundup, it turns out, would have been a very appropriate name for
really.
The Proposition
Absolutely.
And Down in the Valley. But you were not able to get to Down in the Valley. We're going to put that review off. And instead, we took some suggestions from listeners, and we went out and saw the new global warming documentary with Al Gore, An Inconvenient Truth. And we also saw The Lake House with Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves. And we're going to get to those movies a little bit later in the show. But now, let's start with The Proposition.
I suppose I told you there was a way to save your little brother Mikey from the noose. Suppose I gave you a horse, a gun.
So what is it that you want?
I know where your brother Buffer Burns is. It is a godforsaken place.
You want me to kill me, brother?
I want you to kill your brother.
The Proposition is directed by John Hillcoat and written by the rocker, I guess. What do you call him, Sam?
Yeah, goth rock,
sort
Australian goth. Rock, you could go a number of different directions with Nick Cave, definitely.
A lot of different genres that Nick Cave falls into. But yes, screen written by Nick Cave, the musician, directed by John Hillcoat, as I said, starring Guy Pearce from L.A. Confidential fame and also Ray Winston and Danny Houston. And Sam, we got an interesting email here from John Colletti in Wheaton, Illinois, who said, I love the way this film was heavily influenced from great movies like The Wild Bunch and even Apocalypse Now, and yet felt like a breath of fresh air at the same time. What causes that breath of fresh air is the fact that unlike movies critics are comparing it to, like Sergio Leone movies, the most compelling thing about this movie is the story and characters. Despite the fact that the Australian outback is a magnificent sight, we really never witness it on a grand epic scale that we're used to in other westerns. Instead, we are treated to a story of unforgettable characters and a story creating thought-provoking questions like, what's the point of trying to civilize hell? Maybe it's the fact that I'm bitter because I never got the chance to see any great Leone or Peckinpah westerns on the big screen, and I feel this movie makes up for that, but I haven't really been blown away by a film this much in a long time. I hope your opinions will somewhat lie where mine is. If not, I still look forward to other opinions on it. Where does your opinion lie, Sam?
Well, my opinion, I know that, I could only refer to the question, or the conversation that we had right after we had both seen it. And I think you saw this film with your wife, and you were saying, like, well, if I know anything, I mean, we've been doing the show for, 15 months or so?
Yeah.
If I know anything, Sam Holgren will hate this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Hates this movie. Famously, maybe I completely dismissed The Wild Bunch. Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, declaring that I hated it. The cruelty of it, the bloodshed, the exploitation even of it. I just wasn't taken with the whole mythology, revisionist, bloody mythology of the West that Peckinpah created. And this film, Hillcoat's film, has been compared a great deal to Peckinpah's film. And I also went into this film thinking that, knowing it was written by Nick Cave, I imagined that it would be a little too self-involved or like take too much pleasure in the sort of the barrenness, the waste of it. Just seeing, the trailers for it. I mean, it's just like the sense of place is really pretty ominous. The flies buzzing, the bloodshed, and just the growling voices of Pierce and Winston. And so maybe for that reason, going into it, I wasn't expecting a whole lot. The fact is, I did like this movie quite
really?
A bit. Last week, I talked about Winston's performance being my number two favorite performance of the year so far. I think he's brilliant in it, and I think it's really what holds the film together. Largely, I think the film is flawed, and maybe my sort of academic reason for liking the film so much is the real, true sense of place that he creates. It sounds kind of academic, like I'm just liking it for what it does visually. But I think, just with the use of photographs at the beginning, again, this wonderful photograph montage we get of these archival photographs, he immediately puts you in a place that is not the typical West that we know from American Westerns. This is the Australian outback, and it, if anything, is more of a hellhole than the revised Peckinpah American West. for that alone, I liked the film, and I liked Winston's performance as well, but I'll get to a few other things I liked, but tell me what you thought about it.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that you did like the film. I really thought the bloodshed and the griminess of this film would maybe turn you off a little bit.
But it takes too much pleasure really into it, I think.
Maybe
it,
you think it doesn't, or it does?
I don't think it does.
No, I don't think it does either. I think it's very matter-of-fact and just kind of blunt about it, and it's not reveling in it at all. And I have to give John Coletti a lot of credit. I really do. I want to read this line again. He said, "Despite the fact that the Australian outback is a magnificent sight, we really never witness it on a grand epic scale that we're used to." And he says that you're given questions like thought-provoking questions like, what's the point of trying to civilize hell? Really, John, we may have to have him some night come sit in as a guest critic on Film Spotting, because not only is that line so good about trying to civilize hell and so dead on, but his point about how this movie is in opposition to what we're used to seeing is dead on. I just read John's email today. I had glanced at it initially when it came in a few days ago. I just read it today and I was like, wow, he completely nailed my thought about this film, because the thing I loved about it is the fact that, unlike all these other Westerns, even a newer one, a newer take like this, like The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. It's very bleak, the landscape that we're given, and yet Tommy Lee Jones clearly does love his surroundings and puts you in it and shows these really beautiful shots that are in kind of opposition to nature and the beauty of it. But at the same time, you do see the beauty in it. Here, there is no beauty. He has no desire. Hillcoat has no desire to try to make Australia look good,
to romanticize
Australia or the people that live there in any way, shape, or form. You sort of expect that you're going to get this kind of Braveheart thing almost, where you know, you're going to see the evil British, and they're evil. They're evil because they want to take this pure, gorgeous landscape and taint it by trying to civilize it. I don't think Hillcoat is interested really in making that point. The Australians are bad people. The British are bad people. This really is just a hellish landscape and terrain with bad people in it.
And whether they're bad or not, strictly speaking, the fact is they need to create their own morality and trying to impose a kind of civilization, civility. Certainly that's the job that Winston's character, Captain Stanley, is given. And certainly his wife is trying to create a civilization of her own in this wasteland. But I think what he doesn't do is create, create a sort of black and white. And he's not heroic. Heroicizing people necessarily, and I was thinking really about our Western marathon, our initial marathon back in the fall, and was trying to sort of fit this into a revised Western standpoint. I mean, because if you think about the traditional Western, where we have the sheriff as hero, of course, High Noon, of course, and Rio Bravo, etc. And then you have these revised Westerns, later on, let's say Unforgiven, not part of our marathon, but certainly the idea of the revised Western, where we have the outlaw as hero in some way and the sheriff as sort of the villain, as a villainous character. But what I ended up thinking was of one of the films in our marathon, Anthony Mann's Winchester 73, which is really about this sort of like characters that are creating their own or working within their own morality, trying to solve an issue outside the law in some way. And that's what we have here.
It is.
And it really is a really fascinating philosophical conundrum that Nick Cave creates for his character, really, for Captain Stanley. I imagine going into this that this would be Guy Pearce's film. One of the problems with the film is that Guy Pearce is largely forgotten. We never get to know that character. Yeah. We don't really experience the predicament he's put in. Should he, in order to save one brother, kill another? But Captain Stanley's predicament of trying to create a sense of justice when really people are more interested in a kind of biblical justice, like, you know, handing down punishment for those people that deserve it, that's more interesting. The fact is, I don't think, Nick Cave has a problem where he doesn't really want to indict Guy Pearce's character or the brother in the villainous acts of the other brother. He never decides or lets us know how much they've done, how much of a criminal they are. And so Guy Pearce's character sort of floats and is just a vehicle for the story.
No, I agree. That is actually the one flaw of the film, is the movie really does open with Guy Pearce's character. We're put into their situation, not Captain Stanley's situation, though he's the one creating it. And we should say Guy Pearce and his brother, they're outlaws. He actually has two brothers. They're kind of a gang, the Burns gang. Right. And it's Guy Pearce's movie largely for the first 20 or 30 minutes. And then all of a sudden it becomes Captain Stanley's. And while that's really fascinating, because I got to say, this is one of the best bait and switches I've ever had in a film. Where you're introduced to a character, when you're introduced to Ray Winston as Captain Stanley, you think he is just the most evil, kind of stereotypically bad guy, bad overseer handing down justice. And then you find out that that's really not who he is at all.
He's just got a job to do.
He really is a good person put in a bad situation.
It's a really fascinating
character. And he's getting bad. He's turning bad. Even his sweet, innocent wife, Emily Watson, is affected by the area and the people and is kind of bad in her own way she becomes. So it's really fascinating. I love that switch. And yet at the same same time, it does largely abandon Guy Pearce. And I have to say that was my main criticism, is I really thought the film should have focused on him while also getting into that character study of Ray Winston. I wish it hadn't lost him. But otherwise, the things that I really did love about it, besides the landscape, is you talk about movies recently. We talked about this in the Dope Sheet and on the show and listener feedback, movies that waste time with needless exposition. How about throwing us into this gunfight right at the start of this film and hitting us with this proposition? We talk sometimes about being exhilarated by movies. The first 10 minutes of this film, just being thrown into that battle and having to try to sort things out and figure out who people are and where they are and why they're there, that was exhilarating. That was like, this is, like John said, the most fun I had had at the movies all year at that point.
I totally agree.
You know?
Yeah. And the one other problem I had, really, because, I mean, Danny Houston has been praised for his performance in this film, and he's almost unrecognizable in some way. Of course, we saw him last year in The Constant Gardener last year, a completely different performance. And the thing is, I mean, his character is set up. We don't meet his character for, 30 minutes or so, at least 30 minutes. And he's made out to be this really mythic character. Some of the Aborigines describe him as, like, becoming a wolf. And
he's part dog.
It's part dog. Yeah. That's right, part dog. And it really, it's a wonderful description, wonderful writing, and it really creates a sense of drama in terms of introducing this character. The fact is, I don't think he ever lives up to it. He ever lives up to that sense of suspense of what we're supposed to think of this character once he's introduced. He never really does much.
And so,
unfortunately, I think Danny Houston was put in the unfortunate position of having to fulfill a part that had been well-described, but really isn't really written out so well.
We could go on a long time about this
movie. Really could.
This is the unfortunate part of trying to fit in more than one review here, and we are going to get to a few minutes on Inconvenient Truth. If I can, Sam, make one last point about the proposition. I did just want to say, getting back to this idea of the contradiction kind of the classic Western here, in terms of the landscape, what he's really done, if you notice it, is he has not given us any of those shots like you see in Ford all the time. These nicely composed, gorgeous shots of the landscape where characters aren't even in it. It's just us taking in nature. And they're very slowly paced. Here you get the pacing of the editing is very fast, I notice, in this film, actually faster than you'd expect. And when he shows nature, almost always someone's in it. There are no shots sort of let's show this beautiful mountain. There's nothing beautiful here.
It's like man in context.
Guy Pearce is within this context at all times. Characters are always within it. And when you get one shot of him coming across a stream, a brook, and there's a little waterfall or something, that moment is almost like you've walked into the Garden of Eden, because against the juxtaposed against everything else, you almost can't believe it's there, but you don't get other moments like that. And so really, it is kind of a sight to behold in its own way, even though the majesty of it is something he's totally deconstructing.
I think we can agree, a flawed film, but fascinating. One of the more interesting films that we've seen this year, and Winston's performance alone is probably worth seeing.
Absolutely.
Scientific consensus is that we are causing global warming. I am Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America. This is Patagonia, 75 years ago, and the same glacier today. This is Mount Kilimanjaro, 30 years ago, and last year. Within the decade, there will be no more snows of Kilimanjaro.
This is really not a political issue so much as a moral issue.
And that was the former next president of the United States, as he describes himself at the beginning of his film, Al Gore, of course, in his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. To jump into this conversation, this brief conversation about An Inconvenient Truth, here's this email from listener David, who writes, "Now, I do not deny global warming, and I am a proclaimed Democrat, but this film is not only a terribly put-together documentary, it's 45 minutes too long. This film loses the focus of the information of what global warming is and tends to focus more on Al Gore's personal life. Every time the music changed and the presentation Gore made began to dissolve into a scene of Gore driving down the road, was followed by a loud groan from the audience. If it wasn't for the fact that this was a class trip, I would have walked out." Okay, so certainly David's email running pretty contrary to critical opinion and certainly public opinion, who are declaring this film is not only engaging and surprising, but among the more important films that have been released recently. Adam, what are your thoughts?
Well, of course, directed by Davis Guggenheim, but it really is Al Gore's documentary. It really is the forum for him, and the whole film surrounds him. He's about the only character, really the only person you meet in the entire film. And David's email there really was in contrast to the bulk of emails we received from people saying, you have to go see this film. And most people said that, you know what, it is flawed. They acknowledge certain flaws, but they said the content alone is so important and so fascinating that it's important that we go see it. And you know what? I do ultimately agree with them. I think that it is worth seeing because of the fact that I do buy in generally to the idea of global warming. We're not getting on a soapbox here, but I agree that it is a problem that we need to be aware of. And I think that there is some really alarming stuff in there that we should know. Everyone said that this is a 95-minute PowerPoint presentation delivered by none other than Mr. Charisma himself, you know, Al Gore. Right. And that is exactly right. What it is. But I have to say, I was never really bored by it. And Gore, he seems to have transformed himself after the election, and he comes off as good-natured and funny and intelligent, just as he usually does whenever you see him on TV these days. With all that said, though, more than a PowerPoint presentation, saying what this really is a 95-minute Macintosh commercial. That's all I could think watching the movie, is when he's not giving this amazing presentation that he put together on his Mac, all we see is shots of him working on his presentation in his limo, on the airplane, in his office, wherever. Behold the amazingly versatile, powerful, and portable Macintosh. That's literally what this film is saying. And I do ultimately agree with what David said in his email, that the problem is the personal asides in here that Guggenheim clearly throws in to try to break up the fact that this is just a 90-minute lecture. He has to do something else to keep us from getting too bored and just feeling like we're being preached to. They don't largely work. Unfortunately, there are ones like the sequence where we learn about his son who almost got killed when he was six. I could go on about it. I'm going to let you jump in here, Sam, but it doesn't work. It feels forced. It feels fabricated. It feels like Guggenheim needs it to break things up rather than making it fit as part of the natural order of the documentary.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've asked my friend Amy about this, who I wanted to speak to because I know she had told me I really needed to see this film. And so I wanted to talk to her about my response, and she told me that the only person that could criticize this film is a movie snob. I was incredibly critical of this film in speaking to her. I was really honestly surprised that so much praise had been heaped upon this film. And I want to be very clear. Like, this, I think, is among the most important issues of the day. I am really pleased that a film like this is generating the kind of conversation. If it accomplishes nothing else, it's in our daily consciousness. People are talking about it. Whether they're seeing this film or not, it's part of the public debate now, and I couldn't be happier about that. And I don't think this is a political issue, nor should it be a political issue. This is a problem. I do think this deserves a much better film. And maybe it's the fact that this was talked about. It came out of Sundance. It was getting a lot of publicity. I really went into this film thinking I was going to see a really good documentary. It's a bad documentary about a very, very important subject, and I really was turned off by the fact that Guggenheim or Gore, whoever's responsible, really sets out to heroicize Gore. And I think the big problem here for me is that I think it fails I think it fails the test of, would I bring my conservative friends to this film? And that's a really, general kind of statement. But I think it's fair to say that most people, whoever you are, go into movies with a certain kind of expectation. Certainly, if a political official is involved, you're going to have certain expectations about the experience. You have to acknowledge that people that lean conservative might be a little suspicious of what Al Gore is going to tell them. The fact is, I think the movie is unnecessarily political. Spends too much time selling Gore. I'd say at least a third of this film is, or has the appearance of, leftover campaign video. Completely unrelevant to the subject at hand. We know who Al Gore is. We know his personal travails. None of them, including the near death of his son or the death of his sister by, lung cancer, really help us understand what's so important about global warming. In fact, it only detracts from it.
Right.
And I think, honestly, the first 15 minutes, completely compelling and interesting, and then the rest of the film goes on to make the same point over and over and over. And the fact is, that stuff is out there. The mass media is not telling us this stuff, and maybe should be. But the fact is, this information, I think, deserves a better vehicle.
It does. It does. And I guess what I'm saying is the information is so important, and Gore is engaging enough, believe it or not. I think whether you're Republican or Democrat, I think he's engaging enough to make it worth your time. So I do sort of mildly recommend it to people, though I completely agree with you that most of that stuff doesn't work. The only one of those asides that does work at all, I think, is the one about learning that his sister died of lung cancer, because it does kind of tie into the idea of, and what Guggenheim is trying to tie it into, is the idea that they were contributing to this big problem and didn't do anything about it, and now they regret it. And it does tie into this idea of us going through life with this big problem that we all just kind of ignore. So that one kind of works. But these other ones, when you hear Al Gore say, well, my son almost dying put everything really in perspective, and I decided I had to start doing my slideshow again.
Yeah,
how bad does that sound? Yeah. It just sounds lame. It sounds so ridiculous. And there are moments like that in it that are that ridiculous. So, you know, I definitely have problems with it. This is, unfortunately, it is completely propaganda. It is just propaganda. And that is what the problem with it is. Guggenheim clearly decided that he didn't want other things. This isn't a documentary about global warming. It's a presentation. He clearly wanted to just focus on getting his message out. And
but
in a way that is
from
somehow...
I mean, honestly, strictly from a standpoint of like how you put together a documentary, it's really sloppily done. It doesn't look like... I mean, and again, I don't want to get technical because I think that's unnecessary in the fact that it doesn't necessarily disrupt from the message. But I do think the way they cut up the presentation itself is choppy and mm-hmm. doesn't, and this is another big problem of mine, that Gore never once speaks directly to the camera. It's almost like we have a lot of voiceover, we have a lot of shots of him driving around in the country, walking unaccompanied through the airport, but at no point can he speak directly to me. He has my attention for 90 minutes. He cannot speak directly to me about how this much this means to him. And I think the fact is they have all this footage of him.
Yeah.
You know, and I do. I just felt like, for the most part, it was unnecessarily manipulative in their use of music and condescending. And whether or not this is like a beginner-level class for most people because they don't know anything about the problem that is global warming, I was offended by it as a viewer largely in terms of the way it was depicted. And if you want a better lesson, I'm glad the film is out there, but go read Elizabeth Colbert's three-part series, The Climate of Man, that appeared in The New Yorker last year. It is much more compelling, much more interesting, and much better put together.
I don't doubt it.
All right. Well, if you've seen An Inconvenient Truth or The Proposition and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, Film Spotting listeners insisted that we saw the wrong movie last weekend. Instead of Nacho Libre, we should have seen and reviewed The Lake House. Well, what my baby wants, my baby gets. Our review of The Lake House is next, plus listener feedback, and stick around for your chance to win a free DVD in Massacre Theater. Back in a moment.
New heart, old strings, dissonance would always bring the best out of me. In times when I would try too hard, one shot poured straight wouldn't chase away the hate you have for yourself. In times when you would try too hard, hold me now, I'm worthless to the world. Hold me now, what do I know, I'm just a girl.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, apparently a marathon edition of Film Spotting, Sam.
We agreed during the break that we can't do it.
No,
we can't really.
We keep thinking that we're going to be able to put maybe 2-3 reviews into a show, and look what happens.
It's like such a good idea.
We end up going along, and we end up holding back and rushing through things, and it doesn't
work. The worst
of
both worlds.
We're learning as we go. Here, 110 shows in. We're still figuring
out
how to do
this. You heard us. Never again.
So anyway, it is time to announce this week's PureFlix DVD giveaway winner of Night Watch. Just out on DVD last Tuesday, the Russian vampire movie that Sam so loved and I liked
right,
as well.
That's right, my number 5 the film winner, of the year so far.
That's right. The winner is William Nelson from Trotwood, Ohio. Congratulations, William. Look for your copy of Night Watch in the mail soon, courtesy of PureFlix.
In an effort to honor the truest DVD fans out there, PureFlix has launched the Show Us Your DVDs contest. PureFlix is searching for the shrine that best symbolizes a passion for DVDs. Just provide a photograph of your collection and explain a little bit about it. The grand prize is a 400-disc mega DVD changer and a free lifetime membership to PureFlix. You do not need to be a PureFlix member to enter. Learn more at blog.pureflix.com or in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net.
Sign up for a PureFlix account between now and Monday, July 3rd, and you'll be entered to win director Michael Haneke's Cachet, my number 8 film of 2005. It's out on DVD this week. Obviously a movie I strongly recommend. Sam, you didn't love it as much as I did.
Haneke, I love as a director, of course, Piano Teacher and Code Unknown. This a really effective movie, but maybe not as much as the other ones.
Well, I really did enjoy it. And all I have to say is if you do go out and rent it, pay attention. to the last frame of the
film. Pay attention to the last frame of the film. Pay attention to really every frame of the film.
Every frame of the film, especially the last shot of the film. Also out on DVD this week, James Franco, another movie that he was in that nobody cared to see, Annapolis.
Wow, it's like every quarter, every fiscal quarter he comes
Tristan and Isolde came out recently. And then also Matthew McConaughey, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Terry Bradshaw in Failure to Launch. And Sam, I just saw this movie, actually.
What?
We're going to get into it a little bit later. Saw this movie. I'll explain later. And also out Eugene Jarecki's documentary about the military-industrial complex, Why We Fight.
From Warner Brothers Pictures.
This house is about connection.
Comes a love.
Even though this is clearly impossible, it's amazing.
Without limits.
How's your sunset?
It's perfect.
I only wish you were here to share it with me.
And a place that reaches across time.
It is time to talk about the movie The Lake House with Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves. And, of course, the song by Keen, not Coldplay.
That's right.
As I had misstated on the show. I've been corrected. I'm sorry about that. I knew that song, of course, as we talked about. And it is a great song, and I was disappointed that it wasn't in the movie. But we'll get to that later. Sam, this is a film based on a South Korean film that came out in 2000 called Ilmara. And director Alejandro Agresti, this is his first film that I could tell, first English-speaking film that he's done, an Argentinian director. David Auburn wrote the screenplay. He also wrote the movie Proof, another film set in Chicago and has University of Chicago connections to it. And we got an interesting email. We're kind of following this theme here of letting our listeners who've been recommending these films to us. We got a bunch of them saying, you even emailed me, Sam, and said, I can't believe how many people want us to see this film. It was kind of shocking. So we decided,
if there was any film on the calendar that was like, well, we can avoid that one, it was The Lake House.
We thought it was The Lake House, truly. So we got these emails saying we should go see it. So we decided we would see it. And we got this one from Evelyn. And I quoted part of Evelyn in New York, part of her email in last week's edition of The Dope Sheet. While I get why many would not dig The Lake House with its seemingly drippy sentimentality, I think it was actually the better movie this summer than Nacho Libre and found it very affecting and moving. I realize many critics have dismissed it as illogical and lame, and in all honesty, how realistic did they expect a movie with a magic mailbox to be? It's called suspension of disbelief. However, as ludicrous as the plot may seem, I felt the characters were fully realized, and while the pacing was a bit more on the languid side, it was refreshing to see a movie in which it wasn't necessarily about meeting cute and having a fight and then ultimately ending up together, all to a nostalgic soundtrack a la Sleepless in Seattle. Sam, do you agree with Evelyn's position?
Well, I want to answer Evelyn by quoting the villain of An Inconvenient Truth, Senator James Einhoff, who said, I'll paraphrase, recommending The Lake House is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the hosts of FilmSpotting.
Ouch.
I saw this with my fiancée, Carrie, and I was expecting... I go into every film now. I go into it with Carrie, and I'm like, all right, so where are you on the scale of 1 to 10 in terms of enthusiasm for this movie? And despite recommendations from our listeners, I was still hovering around a 2. I mean, the cast wasn't interesting. The subject itself just seemed kind of ludicrous, and I knew I'd have a serious job ahead of me in terms of suspending my disbelief. Expectations low, really low. And I have to say, I spent a good half of the movie just turning to Carrie, and Carrie turning to me and being like, can you believe what's going on? Can you believe what's coming out of these characters' mouths? And I was very careful because my first thought when I came out of here was like, I don't remember hearing such bad dialogue, really like noticeably bad dialogue for a long time. And I realized how dismissive and easy a statement that is, and how frequently people say something like, the dialogue is bad without really explaining themselves. And so I thought about what it means. And I realized that it says a lot about the film as a whole in the fact that you do have this very fanciful concept. And I have nothing against the concept of the magic mailbox and the shared house and 2 years apart and everything. But I think what David Auburn does is he treats it lazily in that he doesn't really create a sense of magic in terms of the way the whole, and you have to blame the director, I think, too, in terms of creating an environment where you can suspend your disbelief easier, because the characters don't end up communicating with each other or with any other people in their lives in a way that resembles the way people actually communicate with each other. And that's my big problem. And I think also Auburn, unfortunately, and I think I had a problem with proof in this way too, where he ends up bringing these really, he ends up indulging his own kind of pretensions, his academic pretensions about whether it's architecture or whatever it is. I mean, really, I mean, there's a really agonizingly painful, conversation between Keanu Reeves and his brother in the film when they're talking about their father, Christopher Plummer's architectural theory in terms of building this lake house, in the fact that it's near everything, but somehow it's
about
apart.
Ownership. It's not about connection.
Right. And it's just agonizing. First of all, you've got, Keanu Reeves saddled with explaining or discussing frequently in the film architectural theory, which is, you know, comical in its own right, but really unnecessary in some way. And I feel like Auburn just wasn't the right person and didn't respect really what this kind of film requires, a lighter touch, a more fanciful touch. And, you know, if you're going to ask people to suspend their disbelief for a film like this, I think you have to go the extra step of actually creating a world where we can believe.
Okay. Well, my question for you then, Sam, even though you just got done talking, is how are you and Carrie going to have a happy marriage
if we can love this film?
When your hearts are the color of coal? That's what I'd like to know. Because, Sam, you haven't been this wrong about a film.
No, you're kidding me.
You have not been this wrong
What's happening right now?
Since American Dream.
The hoax continues. You're perpetrating a hoax on me.
I am not playing a game.
Now, did you go see this movie alone?
I did.
Because Carrie and I were in a room full of 13-year-old girls, and we realized that's who this movie was made for.
Uh-huh.
So in Adam Kempinar's Cold, Cold Heart, there is a core, a warm, glowing, golden core of 13-year-old enthusiasm and romanticism.
I guess so. There is a teenage girl inside of me, Sam, because you
waiting to come out.
The film spotting audience, just disregard every single thing Sam Hallgren just said.
Unbelievable.
He couldn't be more wrong about literally.
You are now perpetrating the hoax against our listeners. You are continuing.
He couldn't be more wrong about
everything. Why do you have to share the pain with
them?
Let's end it here.
No, I'm serious. This movie I found really sweet, really affecting, in a really unmanipulative, un-Hollywood kind of way. I give Agresti a lot of credit. This movie totally surprised me. And I can go point by point with what
you
were saying.
Please do.
You mentioned to me on the phone, because you thought I wasn't going to see this movie, so we talked about it
a little bit.
Yeah,
we
really mentioned to me that there's a line in the film. He says a funny joke or something, and she says, oh, we have a comedian. What did you have, clown for breakfast? Okay. You told me that line.
Yeah, that was one of the points where Carrie
and I
realized,
and I went, oh my God, this movie is truly going to suck.
Okay.
The surprising part, Sam, is that's the worst line in the film. And that's the only true clunker in the entire film. That line is
the
only true clunker.
What about the conversation that Keanu Reeves is having with Christopher Plummer at his bedside about architecture?
I thought it was good.
Terrible.
I thought that worked.
Now, before I just come out of the villain here, I want to say that I thought there were things I liked about it, or at least were redeeming for me, and it was the fact that I sort of felt like I was rediscovering Sandra Bullock, who's completely and utterly charming in this
movie. She is.
And she's very good.
And I've never liked her really in anything.
I don't think I'd seen her in anything since, I mean, of course, we saw her in Crash last year, but before that,
which
she's quite bad in, exactly, and I think we agreed on that. But before that, I really want to say it was like the Grisham adaptation.
Maybe.
That
but she's terrible in that.
Also, the other thing I liked about, there's one central scene in the film. I mean, it really, the film does not work unless this, I mean, well, the film just sort of relies on this and creates, builds up to, and then recedes from this one central scene where they meet sort of in the future or the past, or however you want to put it. And it's really built up to. There's a lot of foreshadowing and everything. And that central scene totally works. It really does. Yeah. I mean, the sense that we know ahead of time that this is going to be the scene where they kiss. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of in a central part of the film. And Keanu Reeves knows who she is and has this whole relationship with her. She doesn't know who he is. And it's really, Auburn does a great job.
Yes, he does.
In terms of like getting us to believe that these people who don't know each other get to know each other and kiss. And it's really, that scene alone is almost worth seeing.
That scene is really good, and it's
Sandra Bullock is amazing in that
it's
scene.
Also really well directed, because this is where Agresti really shows his restraint and holds back, and that scene is almost entirely an unbroken take.
Yeah, it is, like 4 minutes.
You don't get these close-ups, you don't get these shots that you would expect to see in a Hollywood movie, you don't get the music, you have music coming from the party inside, and it's perfect. You don't get the Hollywood kind of music to underscore everything and make it seem important. It's really something you would not see if this film was directed by a Hollywood hack like a Joel Schumacher or a Chris Columbus.
The only good scene in the movie.
I kept waiting for those kind of moments, and there are a number of good scenes in this movie. I really think this is a perfect date movie, I have to say.
Unbelievable. And there are it's two, a great date if you are alone and a married
two,
man,
Sam,
and you're sitting in a room full of 13-year-olds.
There are two legitimate choke-you-up moments in this film.
I can't believe you're saying this. This could be an abbreviated review. You wouldn't have to admit any of this, and now it's on the record permanently.
I even think the ending, which of course I'm not going to give away, I'm not going to say anything about it, but I think I think it's surprisingly effective and actually subversive in its own way.
Unbelievable.
And I really, I have to say too, I want to read one other line from Evelyn, Sam. Evelyn says, to top it off, I also found Keanu to be a surprisingly strong asset to this film. I will never defend him as one of this generation's great actors, but I do admit I find him a pleasing presence
Evelyn
on screen.
Evelyn won't, but you will, won't you, Adam Kemper?
As he's grown older, I found that he's also become a lot more natural on screen. Sam, Evelyn's dead on. You think you discovered Sandra Bullock here?
Yes.
Keanu Reeves is fantastic in this movie.
You're only saying all this because you know no one is going
to
go see this movie.
I'm being 100% honest with you. And let's just say, the only reason I have to go to movies alone, of course, is because I have kids at home.
Because you have two kids at home.
And someone has to stay with the kids.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, if people want to donate to PayPal to finance my babysitter so my wife can go. But no, seriously, I really thought this was a surprisingly effective film. I can't believe how much I was taken with it, actually, considering what I thought it was going to be. Again, I think he really showed restraint here as a Hollywood director, not that a Hollywood director would not have shown the kind of restraint he did. I loved that conversation with his brother about the architecture of the lake house.
Kidding me.
No, it's dead on.
It's seductive,
it's,
even.
It's great. It's delivered perfectly, and it actually makes sense. To someone who's like interested in architecture, you can understand everything he's saying, and it makes sense to you.
Oh, it was like reading a dissertation, like an unbelievable blocky, chalky master's dissertation. Before we get off the subject, this is going on too long. I realize that, but I do want to mention Keanu Reeves, too, because I don't dislike Keanu Reeves in this film, even. And the fact is, like, I realized in my notes, I was putting my notes together, and I realized I wanted to admit something that seems sort of the height of blasphemy, and it is that I've come to like Keanu Reeves, and I realized I was trying to figure out why, because he's not a particularly gifted actor. And this is going to sound incredibly condescending, because it is condescending, but I realized why I like watching Keanu Reeves in particular parts. It is because it is completely comparable to watching your child perform in a school play.
Stop it. Stop it.
It is completely comparable to that, because you can see him making choices so sincerely. He's such a sincere actor. And I think if there was even the hint of pretension in his deliverance of his portrayal of any character, I would lose any patience for Keanu Reeves. But the fact is, he works hard. He's very sincere.
Yes.
You see him making the choices. We talked about how much we liked him in Thumbsucker.
Yeah.
And it's really like, it's sort of charming. And you're just like, what a nice thing
I'm telling you, Sam, though, I agree with Evelyn that I've never seen him actually be this natural. For Keanu Reeves to be that natural, I was shocked by it. I actually was sitting there watching the film going, wait a second, how has Keanu Reeves gotten older and actually turned into a decent actor? That's what I was thinking watching this film.
For me, it's not
film.
Even that he's a decent actor. I just like watching him on
I know
screen.
You do,
I don't
but
mind
I'm saying,
you're
I'm saying he's giving
he's
like
okay.
a conventionally good leading man performance here, not just a fun Keanu Reeves performance.
I also want to say, in a nutshell for me, and this is one thing I told you during our conversation, was any film that uses Nick Drake's Pink Moon in the film.
Now you're just being a snob. You're being
no,
just a ridiculous
I'm just
snob.
Saying, no, I'm not because the
yes,
fact is this film is famous for
I've
being
never heard
in a
it.
Volkswagen ad.
I never heard it.
Are you kidding
no,
me?
No, I never heard it.
Unbelievable. Half, three quarters of our audience will know the film, know the song
Great.
Used in this moment because if it was in a Volkswagen ad, come on.
I thought the song worked perfectly in the film.
I'm a snob, I admit it.
You are. You're a total snob. It's a ridiculous point to even bring up about the film.
All right, fine. I mean, if that undermines the rest of my criticism, fine. Go, film spotting audience.
I don't want to give the perception that I'm saying this is one of the five best films of the year. It's not going to be in my top 10. It's not. It is a flawed film. We don't have time to get into the things that don't work about it, and there certainly are things. But I have to say that I love the way they set up the whole idea of the magic mailbox.
Yeah.
I thought it was really effective. And I liked Keanu. I liked Sandra Bullock. Two performers I've never liked, really, in
I like
many
Sandy
things.
Too.
And
the
they were
supporting
really good here.
My problem, too, one other point that's maybe more relevant than the Pink Moon issue is the fact that I think they treated the supporting cast in a way where they simplified these supporting characters, particularly Christopher Plummer, who I've never seen act so badly in a film, but particularly Sandra Bullock's ex-beau, who comes back.
Mm-hmm.
If that character was just directed to be or acted to be likable, it would have made that whole dynamic stronger in the fact that she actually had somebody real she could connect to. But the fact is, we don't like him. We know she doesn't like him. They have no connection, no chemistry. And so we have to root for it. It's like the director and the screenwriter not trusting us to to experience like the agony of her decision in some way.
Actually, it's just another thing that you misinterpreted, Sam, because while he is unlikable and while it is true that there's...
You can't tell me it wouldn't be so much more interesting if he was a likable guy, if he was like Bill Pullman from Sleepless in Seattle. That's the thing, though.
He is likable, Sam.
No, he's not.
He's more likable than you would expect to see in this kind of movie. He's not just the villainous boyfriend. No,
he's
because
not villainous. He's dull and...
Sandra Bullock, her character, would not even spend as much time with him as she does if there wasn't something inherently good about him. I saw it. He invites Keanu Reeves
and
his
girlfriend to
the party.
Yeah, he throws a great surprise birthday party.
There you go.
That is, again,
they're the wrong match for each other, but he's a good guy. And you get that watching
the film.
It
would have been more interesting if they actually had a connection where she would have been silly not to at least consider being in a relationship with him. As it is, you can't imagine them being together.
I disagree completely.
I can't believe we're fighting about the lake house.
I'm taking ownership of the lake house.
We're going 8 or 9 minutes.
It is a movie worth seeing.
Oh, my God.
Take your girlfriend, take your wife, take your partner, go see it.
Take your 13-year-old daughter.
Take your 13-year-old daughter.
Or if you're 13, which you probably are, and you're the only person that's going to like it, take yourself.
Yeah, well, you're just a snob, Sam.
All right,
that's what it boils down to.
Great opening song, though, Clientele.
Yeah.
First song in the movie that we hear, The Clientele. Great, great song.
It's got a good soundtrack.
Yeah, it does. No Keen, though, unfortunately.
All right. Well, we didn't get to listener feedback at all in this segment, Sam. In fact, we may have to put listener feedback off until
Friday's
show.
Friday, let's do it. Fine.
Okay, that's what we're going to do. So if you do have feedback for us, though, on this review of the Lake House or anything else, send us an email or a short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net. Or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back in Mexico, law enforcement is an entrepreneurial activity. Another round of Massacre Theater and a preview of Friday's top 5 character actors who should be in every movie. Stay with us.
Record sets and box collections littering the staircase to the room that doesn't lead to nowhere. Up inside the house that I rent. Crazy SBLs emitting volumes I remember setting. Sometime when I was more sober, swearing I wouldn't be hungover. And the walk home was an experience meant for exploring. And the ride home was an experience bent on holding. And I hear you're a whore.
They're saying something. Sounds like they're conspiring to conspire. You know, I could feel the lies vibrating from that home.
I don't think she's in on it, man.
Come on, I dream about this. I have actual dreams about this. About busting the top people, the rich people, white people.
I know, but I don't think she's in on it, man.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with my 13-year-old co-host, Adam Kempinar, and I'm Sam Hallgren. Time now for Massacre Theater. Last week, the scene you just heard from Steven Soderbergh's Traffic with Don Cheadle and Luis Guzman, a tie-in with last week's top 5 movies of the year so far. Soderbergh, of course, directed Bubble, my number 2 movie of the year so far. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is... Matt McDowell from Kearney, Nebraska, or is it Kearney, Nebraska?
Kearney, I think.
It's Kearney, I think. Congratulations, Matt. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys got to look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
Bobby, acting is reacting. Now, we're going to play this nice and close, just like in the movies. And...
time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and all we're going to say is that it ties in, of course, as it usually does, with our top 5, and this week's top 5 is character actors who should be in every movie. So, with that in mind, Sam, you get to do
the heavy lifting
this time, and I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
And action.
Do you know who I am, Mr. Blank?
I give up. Who are you?
I'm the Antichrist. You got me in a vendetta kind of mood. You tell the angels in heaven that you've never seen pure evil so singularly personified as you did in the face of the man who killed you. My name is Blank. I work as counsel for Mr. Blank, the man your son stole from. I hear you were once a cop, so I assume you've heard of us before. Am I correct?
I've heard of Blank.
I'm glad. Hopefully that will clear up the how full of shit am I question you've been asking yourself. Now, we're going to have a little Q&A, and at the risk of sounding redundant, please make your answers genuine. Want a Chesterfield?
No.
And scene.
If you know what film Sam and I just massacred, and how can you not, send an email by Monday, July 3rd, to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Tuesday's show. And Sam, we do have to get into just a few quick notes.
That's right.
We didn't get a chance to get into them in our last segment where the heartless Sam Hallgren was berating me. I really felt, you were berating me.
During the break, of course, you were assembling your Lake House fan site. Back after a good 45-minute break.
I was working on it. That's right. It's up now. And everyone writes in, talks about how sometimes I badger you, Sam. How badgered was I? I'm telling you.
I was on the offensive there. I've never been so shocked in the history of film spotting.
Believe me.
/Cinecast.
I'm just as surprised as you are.
Wow.
I obviously had no intentions of even seeing the film.
Pink moon.
But let's briefly mention this week's poll question, Sam. And last week's first, let's do the last week's results. We asked, what is the best film of the year so far? Brick, Inside Man, United 93, Thank You for Smoking, V for Vendetta, or Other?
Other. And Brick, actually, I'm surprised, considering the limited number of markets it's actually been in, came out on top with 25% of the vote. Just behind it, Other, at 21%. And I think we're still waiting, for the most part, to hear from you. What are these other films that were the best of the year? Right behind that, Inside Man, Spike Lee's Inside Man, a film we both liked. Then United 93 at 15%, Thank You for Smoking at 11%, and V for Vendetta, only 9%, which actually surprises me.
Does
only
it?
Because we didn't like it, but we didn't like it, and we heard from people.
We heard from people. That's true. And we did get a lot of great feedback so far on people's top five favorite films of the year, and we are going to get into that feedback on Friday's show. This week's poll question, go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. Sam, apparently, Superman has returned.
I've heard that.
You are thrilled, curious, nostalgic for Christopher Reeve, nostalgic for Dean Cain, hopping off the hype train, or all of the above. Sam, what is your vote?
My vote is curious. Honestly, I was on the film spotting message boards. There's a thread about the Superman Returns movie, and somebody suggested to me that, somebody admitted to just being so excited about this film, and somebody wrote in to say, like, well, we can't all be like the cold, soulless critics like Sam Hallgren.
That's right.
Implied. Just because, and I had to remind them that, of course, who was it that's admitted to weeping openly at a Ron Howard film on Film Spotting? Me.
All that does is
Cinderella.
Make you lose credibility, Sam.
I'm just saying. I mean, I if I truly have a a husk of a heart and soul, maybe it's been wrenched dry from Ron Howard.
By Ron Howard. Maybe that's true. It could happen that way.
You then, so you are.
I have to. I almost went with all of the above, actually, because it kind of applies. I'm curious. I'm thrilled. I'm nostalgic. For Christopher Reeve. I am sick of the hype. I couldn't vote all of the above just because of the Dean Cain factor. I can't say I was ever
You're a little nostalgic
Dean Cain.
For
no,
Dean Cain.
No, not
all
at all.
Right.
So I went ahead with thrilled. I have to say I'm really, really curious to see
what
Singer
is going to do.
Was one of
your most anticipated films of the 2006?
It is. I think it was number two.
You're
and
right.
I the previews so far have been interesting. I like what Singer seems to have done with the film.
Yeah.
It looks kind of like the X-Men films look like, should have looked like, the X3, obviously in a new direction. But I'm curious to see Singer get back
and
to
this. I am honestly coming around to Ralph. I mean, just the look of him. I mean, he says like two or three words in the preview, but I kind of like him.
Yeah.
There's something about him. He seems to have a bit of humility.
Yeah.
And I kind of like it.
It's because he's a good farm kid from
Iowa.
He's
a good farm kid from Iowa.
Okay. It is top five time here on Film Spotting. Time for our 6 through 10. We're giving you a preview of Friday's top five, where we're going to give you our top five character actors, in parentheses, who should be in every movie.
Should be in every movie.
And this was inspired by a list we read a few shows ago. The Onion AV Club recently did an article naming the 10 actors they thought should be in every movie. And we're not going to go over that list again here, but you can go to filmspotting.net and find the link in the notes for this show. And we decided that was a great topic. We were upset that we didn't come up with it originally. And we decided that we were going to go ahead and do our own list here. So, Sam, I know you had some good criteria here.
Yeah.
I ended up using yours, kind of followed it as well. Why don't you set up what your criteria was?
Yeah, the way I thought of it was that, you think of these character actors, you actually want the movie to slow down so they can be in the movie for longer. longer. That's one of my criteria. And the other one is that probably 90% of the people don't necessarily know their name. May recognize the face. May, if you point out the movie they're in or the character, might think of the face, but most people don't know.
Not those. A household name.
Not a household name. And also that they make big, bold, interesting choices that if they don't always work, they're interesting. So I think there are a lot of really great actors out there, great character actors. But these, I think, at least for mine, are making big choices largely and are making memorable choices.
Okay, I like that criteria a lot. As I said, I followed it as well. And we should also say that we did omit some names. We want to just throw
the
out
pantheon.
There already kind of the pantheon. These people didn't match your criteria because they at least didn't meet the one criterion of being household names. They
right.
kind of already are.
Yeah.
They're big enough names that we kind of think people by now know who these people are. And maybe some of them have even played leading men before.
Right.
And so we decided to leave them off. And those people are Alec Baldwin, who you know we love.
Right.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yes, he's the king of character actors, but
now he's a big Oscar award
winner.
He's a
movie star.
Come on.
Christopher Walken, Don Cheadle, Paul Giamatti, and William H. Macy. I mean, now, there was a time when William H. Macy was a character actor, someone
right.
I loved that nobody
yeah.
knew who he was.
Right.
Now everybody knows who William H. Macy is, and Don Cheadle's the same way.
Right.
So those people we deliberately left off, and with that in mind, Sam, you're 6 through 10.
You don't want the dare?
Is your friend here?
No. You're off the hook, Barry. You couldn't make it.
Thank you.
You nervous?
No.
You look nervous.
I feel very happy.
Good. Did you get your gym membership?
A name I think most people are not familiar with, Mary Lynn Ryskub, who played Elizabeth, Adam Sandler's very sort of pushy sister in Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love. What I like about her, very briefly, she never seems to comment on her characters. You know, she always seems to embrace the sort of strongest element of her character, whether they're annoying or obsessive, but she makes really specific choices and never generalizes. And so somebody that like is portrayed as annoying isn't actually annoying to you. And of course, she was wonderful in Mysterious Skin.
Yeah, she is very good in that.
Year.
And she was also great on the Larry Sanders Show.
Right. And of course, she can be seen by a lot of people that may not have seen these films as Chloe O'Brien in 24, a film
Correct.
A show I don't watch, but many people, I imagine, have. I also have another Paul Thomas Anderson favorite here, Luis Guzman. You know, he actually, I was looking on his IMDb page, and he has a quote, actually, appropriate, "Leading men crash and burn, character actors are around forever." Certainly, I hope Luis Guzman is wonderful in Punch Drunk Love, Magnolia, and Boogie Nights from P.T. Anderson. Also a favorite of Steven Soderbergh in Traffic or Limey or Out of Sight. And he's just like, I think there's this really interesting contrast between innocence and menace with Luis Guzman. He's got this look of a tough, and I think he played toughs for like the first three quarters of his career. Now he's a more familiar face. In fact, I think he got like a CBS sitcom for about 5 minutes. You know, last year I was really rooting for that. That didn't go anywhere. But I really just love Guzman. And I was like, I actually decided too, to like, if you're going to see any film that these people are in, go see Punch Drunk Love if you haven't seen it for Ryska. But if you're going to see a Guzman film, go see The Limey. Also have, and I had to throw on here, Kenyan alum Allison Janney, who's, if you've seen Big Night, of course, or The Imposters, but probably most famous as C.J. Craig on The West Wing. She's wonderful. I also have another Big Night alum, Tony Shalhoub, despite the fact that he's from Green Bay, Wisconsin, you know, has this ethnic look. So we know him as, you know, as Antonio Scarpacci on Wings or as Monk now. But a wonderful character actor that I don't think spends enough time in films, honestly. And finally.
Hi, my name is Ray. I'm a friend of Chili Palmer's. Have you spoken with Mr. Palmer since your husband blew up?
Oh, once or twice.
Uh-huh. And what was it you talked about?
Nothing really. This and that.
Well, this and that.
That's Dennis Farina as Ray Bones Barboni in Get Shorty. A favorite film of mine and a favorite performance. And there's something about him that he's got an authenticity. Of course, he's an ex-Chicago cop. And I think he's somebody that knows he never has to play the tough. He just is. And whether he's playing a tough, whichever side of the law he's playing on, he has a kind of authenticity, but he also has this kind of theatrical flair to him that he's not afraid of showing off to. And yet it always feels right on the money. I could talk about these character actors for like 45 minutes.
No, I understand. And actually, that's a perfect place for you to leave off with Dennis Farina, because he was the first name on my 6 through 10 list. Out of Sight, obviously, he's really good in as well. Get Shorty is the big one. Ray Bones, Barbone, you talk about making big choices. And also, I like him in Snatch and in Manhunter as Jack Crawford, yeah. The Harvey Keitel role, I think, later in the Ed Norton version. Yeah. But he's really good.
Or, of course, Jimmy Serrano in Midnight Run.
In Midnight Run, yeah. One of the greats. So Dennis Farina is fantastic. He had to go on my list. And also this guy.
Yeah, Roger Van Zandt.
Yeah, who's this?
You know what this is.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
I sent a guy to deliver the package.
He didn't call. Is everything right?
Tell you what, forget the money.
What?
Forget the money.
It's a lot of money. What are you doing? What do you mean, forget the money?
What am I doing? I'm talking to an empty telephone.
The very cleverly named Sin Addiction, Sam, in our message boards, wrote on this topic of character actors, Heat wouldn't be half as good if William Fichtner wasn't the rich prick Van Zandt. And that clip you just heard, Van Zandt, William Fichtner talking to Robert De Niro's Neil McCauley, is great. And part of what makes that scene so effective is Sin Addiction is dead on, is yeah. The fact that there's just something about Van Zandt and what William Fichtner brings to it, where he comes off as he's trying to be this real badass that he's in control of everything, and in that phone call he's just completely disarmed by De Niro, and what Fichtner brings to that performance is really interesting and fun to watch. And he's a guy who basically can be a bit of a badass and also be a douchebag,
yeah,
which is an interesting line to walk, you know, but that's what he does. And you know, he was number 4 on the Onion list. I do want to point out he was on the Onion list, but he's also in Black Hawk Down, he's in The Perfect Storm, and of course he's in Go, the scene we massacred just a few weeks ago with Jay Moore. That's William Fichtner. So I love him from Heat and others. He's very good. And also I've got Brian Cox, an actor you know we both like.
Yeah.
He's very good in Red Eye as the dad in that, the dad in Match Point, the dad in The 25th Hour. He's in Manhunter, of course, playing the first Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
He's in that. The Bourne Supremacy he's in, and also X-Men 2. We talked about how good he is as Stryker. And of course, another great one is Adaptation, playing the Robert McKee role. He's only there for a short amount of time, but he has such a memorable presence in that film as that screenwriter, and it's all because Brian Cox is so fun to watch. And then lastly, I've got two women on my 6 through 10 list. I've got Tilda Swinton, who was number 3 on the Onion list, but she's very good in Thumbsucker. We liked her performance there. She's also very good in The Deep End, a film we've both talked about at different points, and of course in Adaptation. She's also very good in that as the studio executive. She's only there very briefly, but this is what I like about Tilda Swinton, and this actually goes with all of my choices here in the 6 through 10. Are kind of the theme is people who can kind of be chameleons, people who can play different roles and look different, be very different from role to role. Like I said, William Fichtner can be the weakest person on screen, and then other times he can be a really tough guy.
Yeah.
Here you've got Tilda Swinton. She's always different. She can be this unimposing housewife or be this studio executive who's kind of sexy and sultry, and that's the way she is.
Or
and
just think of her in Broken Flowers.
I was just going to go to Broken Flowers, where she's completely unrecognizable in Broken Flowers. So she's on my list, and also this actress.
Daryl says that you use knowledge to keep me down. He says I'm a yes person, and you are trying to raise us in a no environment.
Well, clearly, no is a word Daryl doesn't hear much.
I can't live here! I hate you! Even William hates you!
I don't hate her.
You do hate her. You don't even know the truth.
Sweetheart, don't be a drama queen.
Fuck you!
That's Zooey Deschanel with Frances McDormand from Almost Famous, and I had to play that bit just because there's something about how funny it is to hear her say, feck you. How many people could pull that off saying, feck you, other than Zooey Deschanel? I mean, she makes it work. She's so good, and she makes subpar material better. She's the best thing about the movie, The Good Girl, a film
Agreed.
I don't really recommend, but actually I do. I say go watch it just for her funny lines, because
luckily,
she's so hilarious.
Luckily there are more chances to see her now than there were then.
But she's very good in that, and I said earlier, I promised that I would bring up the movie Failure to Launch. I was in Vancouver this weekend. I had to fly to Vancouver on business this weekend, and the movie on the plane home to Chicago was Failure to Launch. On the way out there, it was 8 Below with Paul Walker. I chose not
what
to watch
a double
Eight
bill.
Below. But Failure to Launch on the way back, and my computer died. My laptop died, so I had nothing to do, so I had to watch Failure to Launch. And it's the perfect.
And your report is.
It's the perfect kind of airplane movie. It actually is okay. It's I mean, it's not great. I'm sure if I saw it in the theater, it was being very critical.
Adam Kempinar from Film Spotting says it's okay.
Yeah. I say it's okay. Exactly. It's the perfect airplane movie. If you're desperate, it's okay. But she's in it. She plays Sarah Jessica Parker's weird roommate. And it only works because it's her.
Yeah.
If anybody else was playing that character, it wouldn't have been nearly as fun to watch. And she made, again, she elevated material that was really average. She made it fun to watch. So she's on my
list. And,
of
course, just outside my top 10, I wish I had time to mention, is, of course, Terry Bradshaw, one of my favorite character actors.
You know what? He's surprisingly unembarrassing in that film. Yeah. Shockingly. But anyway.
Great on Sunday on Fox NFL Live.
Uh-huh. No, he's better here.
I doubt it. All right. Well, those are the actors that just missed our cut. Believe it or not, we have even more on Friday's show, the top five. Send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or call 206-203-CINNA. That's 206-203-2463. And leave a message. Also on Friday's show, the fifth and final collaboration of Herzog and Kinski. Of course, next week we'll do the documentary My Best Fiend. But on Friday's show, Cobra Verde from 1988, the final Kinski-Herzog collaboration. Something nice and light to finish. Something about the 19th
the
century slave trade.
That'll be great.
Of course, your feedback about the top five performances and films of the year.
Thanks to John Chin and Reverbose Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at reverbose.com. You can also check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and much more, including the Film Spotting message boards at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting.
Also on the blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. Each week, we'll give away a copy of the self-titled CD from Keith Jenkins and the Moving Parts to one random Dope Sheet subscriber. This week's winner is Jay Worth. Email us at feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll send you your prize. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Hallgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting.